plan on flying? It's time to upgrade to a real ID. Because in order to board domestic flights, your driver's license or state-issued ID must be a real ID, or you'll need another acceptable form of identification. So don't wait. Find out how to get your real ID at tsa.gov/real ID. That's tsa.gov/real ID. Or visit your local DMV. And then you'll be cleared for takeoff.
Hello and welcome to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and today I'm excited to have Dr. Joe Hughes with me, who's one of our fantastic neuroanesthesiologists and has a special interest in postoperative visual loss after surgery, and he's coming on the show to talk about that today. Joe, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Jed.
All right, so let's start by just talking about postoperative visual loss. Tell me what it is and kind of how we got interested in it.
We've always known that after cardiopulmonary bypass, people could wake up with unilateral visual loss. It's usually complete, but could sometimes be the upper or lower visual field, and that was caused by atheromata or clot going to the central retinal artery. But starting in about the 1990s, as spinal instrumentation became more complex and the cases became longer and bloodier, we began to see people waking up with bilateral visual loss that was permanent, and the ASA, as a result of that, decided to form a visual loss registry starting in 1999, and this was headquartered at the University of Washington, Seattle, under the auspices of Fred Cheney, but Lori Lee, who's now at Vanderbilt, was the one who headed that up, and they started collecting cases, and these were close claim type cases from the insurance companies. About 40% were submitted. So there was some selection bias, obviously, and some of them were submitted by third party. But that be that as it may, by about 1996, we were able to get together 93 cases and start to analyze what was going on. And there was another study published in 2012 by the same group under Dr. Lee.
Great. So this is a huge issue, right? I mean, we're talking about potential permanent visual loss, and these, at least many of them, are in people with no prior visual problems whatsoever. Is that right?
Exactly. I had a partner in Texas, and she was doing a case, and one of the other partners came in to offer her relief, and she thankfully said no, but her 50-year-old, otherwise healthy patient woke up blind, and there's nothing you can do in most of these cases.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about what we know so far. What are the different etiologies? What leads to or what can lead to postoperative visual loss in people after surgery?
So the different types of post-op visual loss, starting from anterior and working our way posterior, are the central retinal artery occlusion that I've mentioned. And then anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, which involves the area in and around the optic disc where the optic nerve enters the globe and the retinal eyes. And then posterior to that is posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. And then finally, any sort of damage to the occipital lobes can cause central blindness. So what we're primarily interested in today is differentiating between the first three. And specifically, what we have always known is that pressure to the globe is bad. And what we had found with those spinal cases as they were analyzed is about somewhere in the vicinity of 11% were being caused by patients being laying prone on the horseshoe. And it's really hard to position that head in the horseshoe without getting one eye or the other pressed on. So by switching over to Mayfield pins or tongs or using the T-pillow that leaves the eyes free, a lot of that was eliminated. But we were still left with about 87% of those cases, and that's the typically posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. And go ahead.
Okay, so let's just, am I correct that the when we're talking about the occipital lobes, we're going to be talking mostly about a stroke infecting the occipital lobe of the brain?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and so that, if that's going to happen, and certainly could happen postoperatively in the way that a stroke to any other part of the brain could happen, is going to potentially affect your vision and potentially permanently if there's no recovery from that stroke.
Correct.
Is there any increased risk of occipital lobe stroke with spine surgery, or is it the same as all other surgeries, as far as you know?
As far as I know, that unless somebody has some issues underlying vascular pathology, but that wouldn't put you at any other risk, I think, with respect to most spine surgeries for occipital lobe strokes, but it certainly can precipitate problems with respect to embolic phenomena. But that's more, again, from the standpoint of vascularly invasive things like cardiac surgery, where you can get showering of emboli.
Great. And those we see in various lobes of the brain. Right. So as you said, the three that would be more specific here would be the first three that you mentioned, the central retinal artery occlusion, the anterior or the posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. Mm-hmm.
And again, anything that puts pressure in the chamber of the eye can also push on the retina. So if you had an episode of acute angle glaucoma precipitated by a drug such as scopolamine, that could be a problem.
Okay, great. So you mentioned the different frames. So the traditional frame that we maybe are moving away from is the Wilson, is that right?
Yes, the Wilson frame was used for a long time, and it's just that solid piece. You can do a little bit of adjusting, but not really very much compared to a Jackson table. So especially in people who have central obesity, everything is pushed together, increasing the intra-abdominal pressure, which transmits to increased intrathoracic and then increased jugular venous distension. And this is one of the mechanisms we will be talking about as causing venous congestion and almost a venous compartment syndrome that causes problems.
Okay, so we move away from the Wilson frame ideally, and then you mentioned the Mayfield, pins or tongs. So tell me a little more about that. How does the Mayfield frame differ from the Wilson?
Well, the Mayfield is different in that we're talking about, first of all, securing the head, and we want to avoid having anything like a horseshoe up. The horseshoe's fine for supine cases. You can just lie on the head on the horseshoe, but for prone cases, there's really very hard to position the head on a horseshoe such that you don't have both one or of the eyes being pushed on by an arm of the horseshoe. So you can get away from that by putting in the Mayfield pins or their sugar tongs or using our typical spinal white and blue pillow that has a T cut out, the T for the eyes and the little base of the T for the endotracheal tube. And all three of those avoid putting any pressure on the eyes. So that avoids that anterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Okay. So the pressure on the eyes from, let's say, a type of frame or a horseshoe, that is going to put people at risk for the anterior ischemic optic neuropathy?
Well, the pressure on the eyes directly, but the Wilson frame actually does increase venous back pressure and can contribute to posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. So I would make a differentiation there.
Got it. So that's key. So the direct pressure on the eye from, let's say, a horseshoe or a poorly positioned pillow is going to put people at risk for anterior.
Yes.
But increasing intra-abdominal pressure, which causes, as you said, backup of venous pressure, can put people at risk for posterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Yes.
All right. And then are you aware of any studies that have looked at pins versus a Mayfield frame? Is that something that's is one better than the other, or we just know that moving away from a Wilson frame is a good thing?
The Wilson frame, avoiding that for the longer spine cases, it's still used for shorter things like single level discs. It's fine there, but they've gone to the Jackson tables there, and that helps decrease the incidence of posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. The pins, whether they're pins or tongs or the pillow, are all good for decreasing the incidence of anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. In addition, we want to avoid having the head down position because that increases venous pressure. Things that increase oxygen to that area, either transfusing a little more liberally in the longer, bloodier cases, maintaining the mean arterial pressure 70 or above, and being willing to give colloids so that you don't let the colloid oncotic pressure decrease, have fluids leak out, and contribute to what I've referred to as this venous stasis or compartment syndrome that can compress and compromise what is already a kind of a marginal supply of arterial blood to this area of posterior ischemic optic neuropathy behind the globe.
Okay, great. So I want to come back to that in 1 second, but one question that came up that I think people may wonder, we're all taught that succinylcholine can increase intraocular pressure transiently. Is there any reason to think that succinylcholine can make this worse?
No, that the sucks question was more with respect, as far as I'm aware, to open globes and whether you're worried about extravasation of intraocular contents there. But as far as I know, sucks can be used. That being said, I would say that most of us in the neuroanesthesia department, unless there's some specific indication for using sucks, are more likely to intubate using non-depolarizing muscle relaxants. But it doesn't have a bearing with respect to either anterior ischemic or posterior ischemic optic neuropathies.
Okay, great. So now let's move on. I think the majority, tell me if I'm right, the majority of the cases that we're worried about or that we're going to try to prevent are going to be trying to prevent the posterior ischemic optic neuropathy, because the direct globe compression, which is what's going to lead to the anterior, is something that we're pretty aware of and have done a good deal to deal with at this point. Is that right?
Correct. That was about 11%. That's pretty much been addressed, and the remaining 87% is what we're worried about.
And that's the posterior?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So let's talk about the posterior. You had mentioned before some risk factors for posterior ischemic optic neuropathy. Why don't we just review those? What do you think of as the major risk factors for that?
So long and bloody cases in which the old thinking was that you did not transfuse until the end of the procedure because you were going to be bleeding out that blood again, letting the blood pressure go down because the surgeons liked the fact that the field was relatively dry if the pressure was low, not giving colloids because that wasn't standard practice, letting the head be way down so that they had, less bloody field. The Wilson frame that was just what was available then. There were fewer Jackson tables, so you had increased venous back pressure, not recognizing that by being not giving blood, not using colloids, you were forced to use vasopressors, which further compromised the blood supply to this area of concern. And then just not recognizing that people do have underlying anatomical vascular risk factors, and not understanding that this process is a permanent visual loss, so failing to warn people.
Great. I remember as a resident being told that they're limiting the crystalloid that we used was a good thing to try to prevent this, and the understanding was that it would reduce the swelling in the face and that would somehow help. Do you agree with that? Has that been shown?
The facial swelling is more of a cosmetic thing and really doesn't seem to, as far as we can tell, correlate as strongly with what's going on behind the eye. I mean, it can, to the extent that it's overall, you know, you're dumping in a lot of crystalloid and perhaps increasing visual as a marker. But what we're specifically worried about here is trying to shift the curve, so to speak, towards more blood and colloid away from crystalloid, simply to keep fluids within the vascular tree to the extent we can, and also to level the field so that you're not having gravity work against you as well.
Okay, great. So we want to try to use colloids because they're going to support our blood pressure, probably more so than because they're going to lead to less swelling.
Right, but they're also going to, I mean, both blood and colloids will help, I mean, colloids will help that tissue, or that colloid osmotic pressure, so that you're not having as much exudation of fluid across the vasculature into the area surrounding the optic nerve.
Okay, great. Now, there are some studies that have elucidated some specific risk factors. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell me some things that we've found in some of the studies that have been done.
So obesity, the use of the Wilson frame we've talked about, being male, estrogen exerts a protective effect. Age is a factor. Over 50, we know, is a risk factor. Increased blood loss. So 91% of the cases occurred with 1 liter of blood loss or more. Increased operative time was important, more than 6 hours. So if we can get the surgeons to a segment these cases, do them in different sessions, it will help decrease the amount of blood loss. Being willing to maintain an mean arterial pressure greater than 70, that was a factor that was recognized as being problematic. And trying, as I said, to avoid the use of vasopressors by favoring blood and colloid.
Okay, great. So you showed me some great graphs that suggested, as you say, that there were really quite impressive cutoffs at 6 hours where the incidence went way up. I believe there was also an impressive cutoff above age 50 where it went up significantly, and then the estimated blood loss above 1 liter.
Yes.
So all of these were pretty impressive when you look at the increased incidence beyond those levels. Does anyone have any thought as to why estrogen is protective? Why is it that females have that protection from the estrogen? They obviously have more estrogen, but why is it protective? Does anybody know?
That really isn't known. Perhaps hormonal effects on the vasculature, but it's very, as I've alluded to, some of these mechanisms that we talk about are just being elucidated, and there's obviously effects of the estrogen in there, but as to exactly how it operates, that's not known.
Okay, interesting. So let's talk about how, when you are doing these cases, let's say you've got a patient coming in for what's scheduled to be potentially a 10-hour spine case, potential for a lot of blood loss, maybe it's a redo, and what are you thinking, what are you doing to try to prevent, to protect your patient as much as possible and prevent this posterior ischemic optic neuropathy?
So things that we consider, first of all, in consenting the patient, as I mentioned, that we do, in addition to the other things like death, brain damage, and heart attack, mention that there can be visual loss and mention that these are rare but real complications, and we're going to do our best to avoid them. We're going to make sure that we have the Jackson table in the room and not a Wilson frame. We're going to make sure that the table does not get tilted down at all. We're going to have transexemic acid typically here if it's going to be a significantly bloody case, although that can be sometimes hard to get hold of through the pharmacy. We are going to obviously have blood available and use it, not liberally, but use it on an ongoing basis. What I don't want to have happen is to be playing catch-up and explain to the residents this is a dynamic process. We don't want to over-transfuse, but we certainly don't want to get behind the eight ball. So being willing to use blood and, as necessary, FFP and platelets, using Cell Saver for sure, being willing to use colloid, as I mentioned before, the 5% albumin and or 2% normal saline, and just maintaining the mean arterial pressure 70 or above can all be helpful.
Great. So you brought up transfusion, and this is an interesting question. We know that EBL above 1 liter is a risk factor, a significant risk factor for this happening. Does it matter, or do we know if it matters, whether you transfuse or not? So in other words, is lowest hemoglobin a risk factor, or is it just total blood loss regardless of transfusion?
You know, one of the speculated, as I said, none of this is proven, but certainly people being more aggressive in their transfusing, not letting all the blood loss occur and then trying to catch up at the end, as we've seen the incidence go down by not taking that approach. So I think the answer to your question is yes, that letting the hemoglobin go to very low levels and then trying to catch up at the end puts the eye at risk because you're getting decreased oxygen carrying capacity. So less, even though you maintain the oxygen saturation, you're still getting less oxygen delivery to the optic nerve.
Okay, great. So this might be a case where we don't let the hemoglobin fall quite as low as we might in some other cases before we transfuse. So what is your practice? When do you decide to start transfusing in these cases?
I would say that especially a lot of these patients are older, so we have other comorbidities that we're concerned with, such as the heart and the brain. But on average, you know, trying to maintain, say, 8, you know, I know that the common thinking is down to 7, you know, sometimes 9, but, you know, it's dynamic, so I would like to sort of settle out at the end somewhere in the 8 to 9 range.
And are you sending hemoglobin levels periodically to see where you're at? Okay.
Exactly.
And
then when we do the thromboelastograms too, mm-hmm. and those longer, bloodier, you know, thoracic cases or sacral cases where we anticipate that they can get into bleeding dyscrasias.
Okay, great. So what you're looking for on those thromboelastograms is not only whether you're having any kind of clotting dysfunction, but what specifically, right? So that will help you decide whether your patient might need FFP versus platelets and cryo. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so, and then in terms of the hemoglobin, as you're getting your hemoglobin levels back and you're sending these maybe every hour if it's a very bloody case.
Right.
Okay. And then you're going to transfuse when your hemoglobin reaches somewhere in the 8 to 9 range?
If, I mean, it's been rapid blood loss. Yeah. I mean, we try to gauge. We don't start transfusing until it seems some of these cases with the TXA, we don't really need to give much for quite a while, but others are oozy, and it just depends on what the patient's been on. Some of these people have been on aspirin and can be problematic from that standpoint.
Great. Now, the TXA, you mentioned tranexamic acid. So just for folks out there who aren't familiar with it, this, like Amicar, is a antifibrinolytic. So this is going to prevent the breakdown of clot once it's formed. Is that right? And so prevent,
yes.
Help to attenuate some of the bleeding once the body has formed clot.
Correct.
Great. And the way on a thromboelastogram you might see the need for this would be if you start to have breakdown of your clot. In other words, that graph that widens once the clot starts to form, if that starts to narrow again too soon, that would suggest fibrinolysis, and that might encourage you to give if you haven't given some antifibrinolytic.
Exactly. And if you have TXA going, you'll actually see from the start, which we do in a lot of these cases, you'll actually see it widen out. Not a lot, but I mean, you'll know that it's working.
Great. All right. The other thing that was really key, I want to emphasize that you mentioned, is consent. So, you know this is a problem. This is something that maybe we don't always mention in our consent, of visual loss being something that is a risk factor. And certainly if you're looking at a long spine case in a prone position, this seems like it's reasonable to make sure you're telling patients about this.
Exactly. Interestingly, it's actually printed in the paragraph on our written paragraph, but I would submit that most of us don't say it, and a lot of the patients don't read it. So
sure. Okay, good. Now, I want to back up a second. I meant to ask you about obesity. Do you have any feel for what the etiology of why obesity contributes to this? Is it, like you mentioned with the Wilson frame, kind of overall increased intra-abdominal pressure leading to backup of venous pressure, or is there something
exactly
else?
That's, I think, the main problem with obesity, and that's why the Jackson table is preferable, because it gives you much greater latitude to spread the supports and be able to let the central adiposity spread out over the table and hopefully keep your pressures down.
Great. The other thing you had mentioned is not keeping the head down. Obviously, head down is going to cause venous pooling in the head. Do you keep people level, or do you try to keep the head up?
If you can do a little head up, they're not going to let you do much, but they like it level because that helps them with their approach. But if either level or just a tad head up would be good.
Okay. And now, is there any difference in what we see in terms of the risk of this occurrence with the level of spine? And I don't mean how many levels. I mean if it's cervical versus thoracic versus lumbar.
It's usually the thoracic, lumbar, on into cervical. We rarely have a problem with this with the cervical, just the bones aren't as big. You don't get as much bleeding typically.
Got it. That's great. Thank you. So there are a couple other cases you had mentioned to me that were interesting, of some things that maybe would be interesting to point out that can happen and lead to visual problems. If you want to talk about, I think there was one case of a patient with a scopolamine patch.
Yes, this was a lady in her early 40s who was having a gynecologic procedure, who had always had postoperative nausea and vomiting, and so she received a scopolamine patch, and the hospital policy at this particular institution was to remove the patch at the end of phase two. The nurse did not. The patient went home, and she did not have a history of glaucoma, and contrary to her instructions, when she took the patch off, she had it on her finger, rubbed her eye, and she developed acute angle glaucoma, so raised intraocular pressure. She was seen by the retinal surgeons, but they delayed putting a little laser hole to relieve the pressure, so she suffered some visual loss. She sued the hospital, who settled and came back after anesthesia, but the experts ruled that the drug was used appropriately. But I noticed that I tend to be very, very careful with this. I see a lot of the patients in Weinberg in particular on the ERAS protocols who get these, and I always make sure you don't have any history of acute angle glaucoma A, and please, 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 whenever you take this off, typically it's the next day because the patch can last for up to 72 hours. Wash your fingers well. Don't rub it on your eye because you get, even if you don't hang acute angle glaucoma, you get a widely dilated pupil that will persist for several hours. The other case at all that was a gentleman who presented perioperatively with diminished vision to the tune of 20 over 80. His pressures were 190 over 100, and he had an ultrasound shrunken kidneys, and on a fundoscopic exam, flame hemorrhage, cotton wool, macular edema were all present. So he was aggressively treated with antihypertensives, which over the course of the next 6 weeks brought his pressure down to a normal level and had marked improvement on his fundoscopic exam, and his vision improved to 20 over 30. So everything that causes perioperative visual changes is not necessarily due to anterior-posterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Great. Really important to keep in mind and to think about other etiologies. So I want to just sum up the things that we've talked about, and then I want you to, I think you have one other thing you wanted to bring up. So we talked about the main thing we worry about being posterior ischemic optic neuropathy, and we spent a lot of time talking about risk factors and methods for preventing that. We talked about anterior ischemic optic neuropathy being mostly due to direct pressure on the globe, and we've done a lot to try to prevent that with moving away from the Wilson frame and just being more cognizant of it. So we've gotten rid of a lot of those problems. And then we talked about the
it's the moving towards the Mayfield and away from the horseshoes. The Wilson is with the posterior,
right.
And the Mayfield.
Right. Perfect. Thank you.
Anterior.
Exactly. Let me restate that then. So the Wilson frame was the one that causing increased abdominal pressure, leading to higher risk for posterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Correct.
But by moving away from the horseshoe and other things that press on the globe, we've dealt with a lot of the anterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Yes.
All right. We talked about the occipital lobe strokes and those causing visual loss from that aspect. And then the one thing we want to just, let's just nail down, the central retinal artery occlusion. Tell me what's going to lead us to that. What causes that?
So particularly for patients who are on cardiopulmonary bypass, the positioning of the catheters can release showers of emboli, and also just being on bypass can increase the possibility of blood clots because of stimulating inflammatory response. So both blood clots and atherosclerotic emboli can plug up the central retinal artery and lead to either unilateral complete blindness or hemianopsia of the horizontal cuts, either upper or lower in one eye.
Great. All right. So those are our four common etiologies: central retinal artery occlusion, anterior ischemic optic neuropathy, posterior ischemic optic neuropathy, and occipital lobe stroke. And of those four, if you're asked on an in-training exam or on boards, the most common after spine surgery, specifically the most common, is going to be the posterior ischemic optic neuropathy now. And
correct.
Then in terms of overall visual loss, the not just after spine surgery, central retinal artery occlusion is a more significant factor, especially after bypass. Is that right?
Correct. Bypass, the central retinal artery is what you would expect, and the posterior ischemic optic neuropathy is what we worry about after spine surgery, particularly prone spine surgery.
Great. So if people get a question that is asking specifically about a prolonged spine surgery, postoperative visual loss, the most common reason for visual loss in that setting is going to be the posterior ischemic optic neuropathy.
Yes, sir.
Great. All right. And then, Joe, you had one other thing that you were going to mention.
So we've been talking about non-arteritic sources of blindness. The largest category of blindness is actually giant cell arteritis, and this is something where you can impact and save someone's eye. If you recognize it in a timely fashion, you can give massive doses of methylprednisolone and prevent the patient from going bilaterally blind. So just another thing to keep in mind, and that's occurs with a greater frequency than everything else we've been talking about.
Great. So am I right? This is not necessarily directly related to spine surgery, but this might be something you notice in someone in the hospital.
Yes.
And what would you look for? What would be important things to keep in mind that you might see in somebody?
All the associated vasculitic etiologies, you know, somebody who has some sort of autoimmune type process, and being able to order the necessary lab tests, recognize the fundoscopic exam, you know, if you notice someone perioperatively or in the ICU who is having a problem, and being ready to use the steroid aggressively to bring that arteritic process under control before they lost the other eye.
Great. So I think the key here is keeping your differential broad. If you do see somebody postoperatively in the hospital who has some visual disturbance or visual loss, we don't want to just assume that this is from intraoperative events. This could be something related to a vasculitis, something that you might be able to intervene on and make a big difference if you keep your differential broad.
Yes.
Great. Joe, anything we've missed?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. All right. That's it for now. Remember, you can go to the website at acrac.com, that's ACCRAC.com, where you can leave comments on this episode, tell us what you've seen in terms of postoperative visual loss, what do you do to try to prevent it, are there things we didn't mention that you think are important, leave comments there so that everyone else can see them and can comment in return. You can also email me at acrac@acrac.com, that's ACCRAC@ACCRAC.com. On the website, acrac.com, you can also sign up for our mailing list in the upper right-hand corner, where you'll get notifications when new episodes come out, and also any interesting materials that I may one day send around. I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving. For the ACRAC podcast and for Dr. Joe Hughes, I'm Jed Wolpaugh. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.